Hey, my name is Nadine, and welcome to In Her Lens. This podcast centers underrepresented voices in film and television. So I mostly just talk to the most exciting minds at work in the industry today and discuss their equally exciting work. In this third season, we are getting to know people who work in the climate and film space, those with climate change and inspired action at the front of mind. I have spent and am spending a lot of time wondering about the place of filmmaking and visual storytelling in the fight against climate change. In this episode, I am honored to welcome Dr. Laura Yu Marks. Dr. Marks is a media scholar and philosopher. She is an author and the founder of the Small Foul Media Film Festival. She teaches at the School of Contemporary Arts at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, where she works on media art and philosophy with an intercultural focus, and on small footprint media. More on that later. She is the author of multiple books and publications, including the cultural philosophy theory book, The Skin of Film. So how did I find Dr. Marks' work? In the pandemic, as maybe a lot of us, I spent a lot of time on Netflix, on HBO, on my phone, on social media. I spent a lot of time FaceTiming family and loved ones who lived in different countries. Maybe it was somewhere between binging Handmaid's Tale and The Ultimatum that I realized that we are constantly getting streams of high-res content, whether it's on your TV screen or your laptop screen or the little square that's tucked away in your back pocket. What is the impact of all of this high-definition content? Is there a carbon footprint to all this mass streaming? So I came across Dr. Marks' work when I started my research into the carbon footprint of streaming media. I was astounded, to say the least. In a 2021 published report by Dr. Marks, working alongside a team with multiple ICT engineers, they found that streaming media is calculated to contribute to a surprising 1% of all global greenhouse gases. So if I distill this all the way down, this is because most regions of the world obtain their electricity from fossil fuels to power their data centers, their networks, and their devices. Streaming large files in large quantities then ethically implicates us spectators in the warming of the planet. Dr. Marks founded the Small Foul Media Film Festival in 2020 to raise awareness about this scary carbon footprint of streaming media. The festival proposes alternative solutions for media practice. It features only small foul eco-media, movies that are compressed at a rate of 1.44 megabytes per minute. That is what fits on a good old floppy disk. They aim to remind us that great cinema doesn't have to mean great big files. Now, in this episode, we talk about why streaming media has a carbon footprint. Dr. Marks explains the differences between going to the movies versus turning on Netflix. We discuss the rebound effect as it pertains to data usage and growth models. I ask Dr. Mark about the ICT industry. Instead of being efficient, can it be self-sufficient? Dr. Marks uses Lebanon and its fragile electrical grid as an example in discussing renewable electricity sources and why we may or may not be using them. Finally, we discuss small foul eco-media, the value of it, and her concept of soul emblages. This is I want to call it Godzilla of a subject. It's huge. It's completely enveloping. It's also really exciting to learn about what we can do as consumers. It's also exciting to learn something new. I'm so grateful for Dr. Marks for being here and illuminating the path that we are on to talk us through it. I've linked all the research reports, as well as Laura's previously published works, in the episode notes in case you'd like to read more in depth or follow along a little bit more closely. Without further ado now, here is Dr. Laura Marks on In Her Lens.
Hi,
Dr. Hi. Laura Marks, thank you so much for being here and being a part of In Her Lens Season 3. It's an honor, truly, to have you. I start off this season now in every episode by asking four questions that I've designed around the year's season, just kind of like a rapid fire to get us grounded. Would you like to join in on those seasonal questions?
I'd be delighted.
Okay. Spring is the first season. What is the first thing that you do when you wake up in the morning?
Oh, that's really a hard one.
If there is anything.
Well, I probably make some Turkish coffee.
Good. Yummy. Mm-hmm. The summer question is that if you could go to any concert by any artist, alive or past, who would you go see?
Oh, I might go see Snarky Puppy.
Cool. In the autumn, tea or coffee?
Coffee always.
And the winter question is, do you have an affirmation or a resounding word that you carry with you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a few of them. One was given to me by my friend Judy Radul, and it is stay the course.
I think that's a beautiful note to start off on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for those questions.
Of course, of course. You work at the intersection of media art, philosophy, and you have an intercultural focus, but you are also very specifically focused on small footprint media, which is how I came across your work. Mm-hmm. And you're also a professor at Simon Fraser University. I'm thrilled to be spending time with you, so thank you. Ahead of us tackling this big topic of, or talking about, trying to tackle carbon footprint of streaming media, I would like to take some time to get to know you. Mm-hmm. Will you tell us a little bit about your childhood, where you grew up, and do you remember your first brush with cinema?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Well, I was born in Baltimore in the States, spent my first 10 years there, and then we moved to Canada, to Southern Ontario, and I lived in a quickly growing, very multicultural city called Mississauga. And I think one of the first films that really affected me was Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. When I was 7, I just fell in love with that movie. Mm-hmm. And I got a friend to reenact it with me, and I always made her be Romeo.
I love it. I love thinking back to those games and to those playful things you do as a kid and finding like what role interested you in those stories. What was your academic life like? How was school for you? And did you study? How did that develop for you?
Oh, well, in high school, I was very smart. I was always a nerd. But it wasn't until I went to college and actually went to an American college. We didn't have that kind of thing in Canada, a small liberal arts college called Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. And it was only there that I really found a lot of other people who were like me, who had been kind of, you know, weirdos or outcasts in high school and who had, you know, very particular interests. And I found out about all kinds of fields of learning that I had no idea existed, and also making art. So that was a real blossoming time for me.
Mm-hmm. And you come from the humanities. What inspires you about that field, and specifically about research as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a very big question, Nadine. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that really started it off for me was realizing that by studying the history of the arts, you can learn everything about the world, and you learn it visually. You learn about what people are like, you know, in the past and in different cultures. You learn about politics. You learn about trade, you learn about materials. So that was a fantastic education for me. And I think it also explains why, even studying cinema, I'm drawn less to story than to what the visual image can do and experiments in perception and experiments mm-hmm. in sound.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in the trajectory that you chose to explore and the subject matters, especially in media and in intercultural focuses. Mm-hmm. How did that develop coming out of college? Do you remember your first professional stint? Mm-hmm. How did that mm-hmm. look?
Well, after college, I worked for a few years on an independent art magazine called After Image. And it was really there. This is the late 80s, early 90s. It was a very left politicized magazine. And, weirdly enough, I had, the writing sample I submitted to them was a college essay about the Japanese tea ceremony, which I'm sure they found was kind of ridiculous. But they did hire me. And I very soon found out about this really lively and very political field of independent film and video. Mm-hmm. And I started covering film festivals. And I was especially attracted to films and videos made by immigrants or cultural minorities. And the way they see the dominant world that they've been imported into from their perspective, this really interested me. Yeah, I think because of certain ways that I'd been brought up to be mm-hmm. very curious about other cultures. So at some point mm-hmm. I thought, well, I better go do a PhD. And and these ideas about the perceptual knowledge that people have who bring one set of cultural knowledge into another dominant culture. These informed my dissertation in my first book, The Skin of the Film.
Yeah, which I think is, I've read parts of it in preparation for this, such a beautiful concept. And I think I want to touch on it as we talk about eco-media a little bit later mm-hmm. as well. There is so much to cover, so I'm going to just hop right in mm-hmm. to the topic that at hand and why we're here, which is the carbon footprint and streaming media. Mm-hmm. This, I want to say, big labyrinth of ICT information, mm-hmm. communication technologies. I felt particularly pulled to this part of climate change and filmmaking and that intersection because I do feel the intense presence of streaming media in my personal life, especially during a post-pandemic. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be very honest also, all the listeners, I'm not an example on this. I don't have a TikTok account, but I practically do with Instagram Reels. I have access to all the streaming platforms. I FaceTime people. All of these things fall under streaming media. But I've barely scratched the surface, I think, of this topic, and mm-hmm. let alone adjusted my own behavior. But I'm very invested in this mitigation of streaming mm-hmm. media. And I'm very grateful to be on this journey and to learn. So that was a whole mouthful, but I really do just want to be honest. And I think we're all recovering hypocrites in the fight to become more present human beings and community members. I think it's good to start at the beginning and understanding energy, electricity, and that connection to fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Will you explain to us a little bit how streaming media has a carbon footprint
yes.
and how that implicates a spectator?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for asking, Nadine. Well, it's because streaming media rely on information and communication technologies, and those are divided into three parts. The data centers, where those media are stored and where calculations are performed on them, the networks that transmit them from the data center to your device, and our devices, whether it's a mobile phone or a laptop or a smart TV. And each of those is responsible for roughly a third of the electricity consumption of streaming media. And the carbon footprint comes in when you consider the source of the electricity. And there, you have to kind of calculate it for every single thing. But since we know that worldwide, about 79% of electricity comes from fossil fuels, We know that on average, most of the energy that's powering data centers, networks, and devices comes from fossil fuels. And I want to point especially to the production of devices. There's only a small amount of devices' energy use comes from when we plug them into the wall socket. The great majority, 85 or 90% of that electricity is used in the factory. So usually in a factory in China, always using electricity that comes from a mix of energy sources, but with a lot of fossil fuels in it.
Mm-hmm. There are three kind of differences, as you just touched on, which let's discuss it immediately. Going to the movies, DVDs, and streaming. How do those three forms of watching moving image differ, and where do they fall in that spectrum?
Yeah, well, I mean, going to the movies, we're not streaming, so we're not reliant on that, on all of those sources. We're not reliant on ICT, information communication technologies. You know, the very fact of a lot of people, you know, watching a movie together is, it's not only a nice thing to do, but it does not exert that that pressure at all on information communication technologies. But of course, you know, if we're driving to the movies, then that would, you know, mitigate our savings. But, you know, if we're lucky enough to be in a city where we can walk or take transit or ride our bikes to the movies, then that's a very low carbon experience. Now, something like DVDs, or you know, my slightly futuristic wish is that we would have a video store on the corner where we could just take a USB drive and they would load me movies onto it. That would be great. That's because nobody really likes DVDs. But DVDs are a great way to save on the carbon footprint of streaming, especially if this is a movie that people are watching again and again. So I get tons of DVDs from the well-stocked public library that I'm lucky to have. And for the more rare movies that I love, you know, somebody gives me the DVD or I purchase it. So, I mean, sure, there is the energy that goes into producing the DVD and its case and shipping it somewhere. But if that DVD is going to be used multiple times, then that's a very good savings. Another option is actually, before we get to streaming proper, another option that is greener than streaming is to download a file, if it's something that you're going to watch more than one time. So streaming itself consumes, you know, collectively is responsible for a lot of carbon emissions because it is one of the major pressures on information communication technologies. The others are artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, and other uses of large files, like storing your photos in the cloud. But the thing is, if I can get a little bit complicated here.
Please do.
So the thing is that those data centers and networks are over-engineered in anticipation of increased future demand, and also in anticipation of, you know, in quotes, disaster, which usually just means that, say, the network goes out for a couple of seconds. That's a disaster because in our capitalist economy, if one telecom or one streaming platform has a weakness in their network, then the consumer might just go to the competition.
And right.
So in order to avoid that, networks and data centers are built to forefend any such eventuality. So they're way overbuilt. So mm-hmm. what this means is when when we are streaming movies or doing other things that put a lot of pressure on networks and data centers, those networks and data centers are already engineered to support that. It's it's rare that that consumer activity maximizes the use of that infrastructure. It did happen at the beginning of the pandemic, at least here in North America, probably in Europe too, that there was so much pressure on, Netflix, YouTube, and PlayStation, that those companies had to lower the highest possible resolution to standard resolution because so many people were using them at the same time. But what it means is that our activity is just fulfilling a demand that was already predicted. There's an ICT engineer says a good metaphor is that the airplane is going to take off no matter how many passengers are on it. So we could use that to say, well, you know, my individual activity is not going to make any difference because the data centers and networks are already, they have more than enough capacity to support my additional streaming. But in fact, that infrastructure continues to expand in anticipation of even more use. So in fact, our individual activity does make a difference.
And that kind of relates to the concept of the rebound effect.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Could you explain that a little bit for the people who don't know what that is?
Yeah, the rebound effect. It's also called the Jevons paradox, from Jevons, British guy in the late in the 1880s, who noticed that when coal became more easily available and cheaper, people just did more stuff that needed coal. So the demand for coal actually grew. So similarly with streaming, when streaming becomes easily available and cheaper, the demand for streaming grows. And we've seen that in the last 10 years, the streaming proliferated over so many different platforms. I mean, there's YouTube and other tubes. There's video on demand. There's streaming on social media. Streaming via websites, video chat, video conferencing. Peloton decided that people want to watch a 4K video while they're working out. You know, these applications are just, new applications are popping up all the time. So the expand is increasing. So I think our goal is to, I don't think we'll be able to decrease that carbon footprint, but we can prevent its rise. Because I haven't mentioned yet that information communication technologies as a whole are responsible for about 4% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And that's the same as the aviation industry. And this number is also calculated to be expanding by about 9% a year. So it is a real, it's a really large contributor to global warming.
Yeah. You worked on a research paper titled Calculating the Carbon Footprint of Streaming Media Beyond the Myth of Efficiency. Mm-hmm. And you and your fellow authors developed models to measure these footprints. Mm-hmm. How do you create something? Can you guide us through what happens when you're creating a model and kind of the technical details of data collection and analysis? Because I do think that's still the idea, the image, the numerical example you can give behind a carbon footprint is a really impactful way to get people on board or listening.
Yeah, thank you for asking. That paper was co-authored by the four people on the team I put together. Two of us are media scholars, me and Radek Pszedpowski, and two are ICT engineers, Stefan Makanin and Alejandro Rodriguez Silva. So the four of us worked together for a year at the beginning of the pandemic, meeting once a week online to go over the engineering literature and read all the other studies that were trying to analyze and calculate the carbon footprint of streaming video. And there was so much controversy between them, which is really interesting to talk about. A lot of it I thought was quite political. We saw that there is still a need for a good and simple model to calculate that footprint. Now, it was my engineering colleagues who built the model, but I understand well enough what they did that I can explain it to you. It's actually not that complicated. For a given telecom, because you have to be able to identify the data centers and networks that are involved, and also the devices, the consumer devices. There are certain formulas that you can use to calculate the activity of different size of data centers. So you add that in. You use other formulas to calculate the activity of networks depending on amount of traffic and time of day. And maybe the most complicated is calculating the energy usage of devices, because there's so many different kinds of devices and you have to estimate their lifetime. So you have to think, you know, probably most people get a new device every 2 years. Mm-hmm. So this points to the fact that one of the best ways that individuals can mitigate that carbon footprint is just by not having too many devices and by keeping mm-hmm. them for as long as possible. And then some more research that we actually don't talk about much in that paper, but that I've begun to pursue myself is how do you figure out the energy source for each of those three things? And that is really interesting because you need to find out where are the data centers located. And sometimes you can often find, there are ways that you can find that out. And then you need to find out in that region, what is the energy mix that supports the data centers. So if it's all renewable, you're like, okay, well, great. But you still have to think about, if it includes fossil fuels, then you have to calculate that in. Same with the networks that go between that data center, which might be in another country, and the source. You need to figure out the energy source of networks. And then for devices, and this is something that my colleagues have worked on a lot. Well, first you need to factor in the energy consumption that occurs in the factory and what was the energy mix there between renewables and non-renewables. Then you have to look at the energy source at the user's site. So it's not difficult to understand, but the engineering models used, and this is where my colleagues and not me are the experts, the way you calculate it and the assumptions you make and the previous research that you draw on, all of those are crucial, and you'll come up with a different result depending on which data and which models you draw on.
Right. And you mentioned that you found that some models were very political. Mm-hmm. Could you share more mm-hmm. about how could a model be political? And is that based also on, exactly like you said, where the data is coming from that's being input?
Yes. I think, you would think that engineering is this very kind of dry, objective, field
thing.
But even my engineering colleagues were really surprised at the great disparity in the research. and also that the kinds of claims that the engineering researchers were making. So like even within like the very small amount of ICT research that that is thought of as green ICT, there's a range of views from a more conservative end saying, you know, we really don't have to worry. Data centers are going to keep on being very efficient for a long time. And, I think they kind of lowball the estimates. And also, you know, in the U.S., one or two of these research groups have a connection to the International Energy Agency, which is seems to be very invested in minimizing the concern about the carbon footprint of ICT. So they tend to lowball things and to attack people who say that there's something to worry about. But they also tend to say, well, the government really should be paying, should be supporting the expansion of ICT infrastructure, which I find kind of weird. And then at the other end, there are some people who are way too alarmist and way too extreme and who use kind of too quickly grab calculations that are not sound, but are really kind of horrifying. Like, you know, by 2050, you know, 40% of the world's carbon footprint is going to be from ICT. So those are the extremists. There's some people in between. I'll show you my favorite book. Mm-hmm. There are some people in between who I think of as the moderates. People like Lawrence Hilty and Bernard Ebischer, who are the editors of ICT Innovations for Sustainability. They're European researchers, and there's some other researchers in Germany, some in the United Kingdom. There's some people in the United States who are involved in the slow tech movement. All of these people, which was founded by Bonnie Nardi and other scientists. So all of these people have a moderate view. So unlike the more conservative green ICT engineers, they are not, they're basically not supporting a capitalist model of growth. So I hope this is not getting too kind of wound in on itself. So the more conservative engineers, I think they're doing research, you know, as most engineers do, because engineers are, you know, their research is helping corporations and governments, you know, who want to support a capitalist growth model. So they're under a lot of pressure to say, yeah, no worries, it's going to be fine because of Moore's Law, you know, computers and data centers and everything are getting so efficient that there's really no worries and we can continue to support exponential growth for the capitalist economy. Whereas the moderates who I like are saying, no, we have to stop the cycle of growth and we have to halt ICT engineering's support for the fiction that the infrastructure can keep on expanding without using a whole lot more energy, or the notion that yes, it's going to use more energy, but people are going to use less energy and other things, so it's okay. And they're saying, no, we really need to make decisions that will minimize the amount of electricity that ICT uses. And this involves delinking from the capitalist economy.
I feel like a lot of the conversation I'm having in this season are linked back to that growth model that exists in capitalism and how intrinsically it's linked to climate breakdown. Can ICT develop from being efficient to being self sufficient, mm-hmm. do you think?
Yeah, that's an argument that Lawrence Hilty makes, among others. And as I recall, he and some other people argue that self-sufficiency means that the amount of electricity we consume has to be completely recovered by the generation of energy from renewable sources. And this realistically requires massive cutting back, because right now, and we know very well that all over the world, there's more investment in renewable energy than ever before. But by some calculations, it's only enough to support the increased electricity consumption. So in fact, if we're going to keep going along the way we are, we're going to be using as much or even more fossil fuels, and also installing all these new renewable energy sources to help support the increased need for electricity. So the only way, even if we do like quickly move to renewables, the only way we can try to wean off of fossil fuels is by decreasing overall electricity consumption. Mm-hmm. So making do with less, accepting that sometimes, the network will go down, and other ways of creatively making do that I find are really well modeled by people in, what I think is wrongly called underdeveloped countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to touch on that. I think this would be a relatively good segue to talk about also the differences in infrastructures between what people call well-developed countries and their consumption versus countries with more fragile electrical grids. Mm-hmm. Do you have any case studies that show the difference between these two?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And there are, just in terms of statistics, but not case studies, I've noticed in passing that there are some Sub-Saharan African countries, Rwanda comes to mind, that have very low electricity consumption for obvious reasons, and also use a lot of renewables. And I actually think that Rwanda is like a model for us in the wealthy world to make do with less and use renewable energy. But the case studies that I am embarking on are in Lebanon and Egypt, because those are places that my other research takes me to. So in Lebanon, I just started gathering some information. And Lebanon, up until recently, has relied 100% on fossil fuels. But the electrical grid is so fragile that, people are only getting a few hours of electricity a day from the government electricity company, Electricité du Liban. And so a lot of people, first of all, people were just relying on diesel generators, and mostly people still are. But more and more private people are turning to solar. And in Beirut, you can see solar panels on a lot of rooftops of homes and apartment buildings and businesses. So this is really interesting that, because the government-provided electrical grid is not functioning, individuals are turning to solar. And I had a very interesting conversation with an engineer who works for Ogero, which is a national telecom, who said that the vast majority of the Lebanese national telecom's budget goes to pay for diesel for generators.
Wow.
Which is just, isn't that awful? And this company, Ogero, would love to convert to solar. But here you get into Lebanon's very nasty kind of clan-based politics, where the government ministers control the importation of fossil fuels into the country, and they force Ojiro to keep on using diesel. Doesn't that make you want to like pull all the hair out of your head?
Completely. Oh, it's just like a cold ice down your back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the small upside is that people in countries like Lebanon, where bandwidth is in most places not very good, and where the electricity can't be counted on, they are getting used to streaming in more judicious ways. So like not uploading large files because you can't count on it working out, or finding alternatives to streaming, like the video bootlegging is a lively industry, and some people can still do it physically. They can. That's where I got the idea about taking your USB to the corner bootleg shop, because that is a practice in Lebanon. So we would just have to find a way to make that legal, and everybody could do it, and the distributors could still make money.
Yeah. Really good. Really good from whoever's listening. Ding, ding, ding. I want to touch on one more thing before we move on to small file media. I read about this unused data that's in data centers, and that's also part of that footprint. What is unused data? Mm-hmm. And is there such a thing as a green data center?
Yeah. I don't know much about unused data. I think that there's a lot of space on data centers. So they're not full. And I think that's just that over-engineered extra capacity, anticipating future need. But don't quote me on that. What was your other question again, Nadine?
If there is such a thing as a green data center.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I mean, there are companies that famously say that their data centers are green. Alphabet, which is Google, does that. Apple does that. But it's not really true for a couple of reasons. A lot of that, the way they can do that is through by purchasing credits.
I think YouTube does this as well. Calls themselves carbon neutral.
YouTube is owned by Alphabet, Google.
Oh yeah.
So so they claim to be carbon neutral, partly because they're just purchasing carbon credits from other companies. But also they like when they're tapped into a national grid. If they use a lot of electricity that comes from renewable sources, this happens in Ireland, as my colleague Radek shared with me a couple of years ago. So in that case, there's all these networked corporations that have their headquarters, the European headquarters in Ireland because of the tax base. Mm-hmm. And Google, Apple, Amazon, they put so much pressure on the grid that the national electric company, IREGRID, actually had to bring a couple of retired coal-powered electricity plants back into circulation.
Wow.
So if the data centers are using so much electricity that they force the national government to use fossil fuels again, then they may call themselves green, but they're forcing other people to be brown.
Right.
We can think about the cooling of data centers. Google has data centers in the frozen north, or places like Iceland, because cooling uses a huge amount of electricity. But is this the best use of frozen land to use that snow and ice to cool data centers, especially when the globe is heating up.
Mm-hmm.
So
very good question.
Things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You are the founder of Small Fowl Media Festival, which is super cool. It features small fowl eco media, so movies, films, moving image compressed into very small fowls, generally what fits onto a floppy disk, showing that all of us that good cinema and good storytelling doesn't have to mean these big fat files. What is your definition of eco media, and why did you start this festival?
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to talk about something fun now.
Yeah, I was like, we have to talk about how we bring it elsewhere. Yeah,
So we at the Small File Media Festival define small file eco media as movies of no more than 1.44 megabytes per minute. So, and we chose that figure because a floppy disk holds 1.44 megabytes. So you could put a 1 minute small file movie on a floppy disk. We wanted it to be somewhere between 1 megabyte per minute, which is just a little bit too rigorous, and 2 megabytes per minute, which is a little bit easy. But for comparison, the average standard video uses between 60 and 350 megabytes per minute. So it's a tiny fraction of standard
which is
video.
So cool.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. when did you start the festival? I think it's 4 years ago now.
I founded it we're in our fourth year. I founded it in 2020. And pulled together an amazing team of artists and activists here in Vancouver. And actually the first year we meant it to be a live festival, but because of the pandemic, we were forced to do it as a streaming festival, which was actually perfect because we also define small movies, small file eco media as movies that stream with no damage to the environment, because they use up so little space in data centers and networks, and they put so little pressure on the playback devices.
Really awesome. What does if you're going through submissions now, what does a submission have to adhere to apart from the size that you already touched on?
That's all. It only has to be 1.44 megabytes per minute. We used to say that they should be a maximum of 5 megabytes or 5 minutes, but now we have this more inclusive criterion. So the movies can be as long as people want. We've got some that are, we don't have any features this year, but we've got some that are 15, 20, 30, 45 minutes.
Which is also just your imagination can run wild with it, which I think is, it's such a great parameter in terms of really thinking about creativity and how we create. When you start a festival like this, what is like? Do you remember a hurdle that you did not expect to run into when you maybe did the first iteration?
Well, I mean, you know, once we realized that because of the pandemic, we had to do it as a streaming festival, it was a hurdle that turned into a good thing, and you know, we created this wonderful international online community. Small files don't have hurdles. Well, no, honestly, that's not true. The hurdle is acceptance, of course, and it still is. You know, a lot of people, you know, people hate low resolution, like really hate it. And a lot of people feel almost personally offended, you know, when someone suggests to them that a movie would look just as good at a lower resolution. So we're trying many different ways to seduce the audience into seeing that small files can be beautiful, immersive, great storytelling, you know, they're not going to replace super high definition video, but you know. How often do people really need that? Like one of our categories this year is tiny talks, because TikTok videos are about 60 megabytes per minute. So we invited artists to submit TikTok style movies that are small files to show that, you know, on a commercial platform like TikTok, you can share in that fun, dancey, social way in a much lower resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is like, again, creative and a challenge, which I think is so exciting. What we talked about this, but what opportunities do you see apart from in, like, these TikTok in compressing and in maximizing on less on a creative spectrum?
Mm-hmm. Oh, tons. And I actually think that small file media are the newest avant-garde, really. Like in the terms of a modernist avant-garde, where the medium creates this constraint that the artist works within. The small file constraint is incredibly productive because artists come up with all kinds of means, and it's not all about compression. There are all kinds of things that you do in your camera work, in setting up the mise-en-scene in front of the camera, even in performance. For example, if you have actors, you want them to move more slowly. You might want the camera to use a shallow focal plane, so there's not so much action in the background. You might choose to use still images rather than moving images. All kinds of things that happen before you get to the point of compression. Also, you might choose to use an older camera that starts out with a smaller file size. And then, yeah,
which kind of adheres to what you said also about keeping your devices for longer and that carbon footprint also getting involved.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So you're embracing the imperfect beauty of the images made by an older camera. And then in compression itself, you can either compress in a very skillful way that will retain as much image quality as possible, or you can push compression aesthetics and really make, you know, the blockiness or the softness or the contrast or the data moshing into its own aesthetic element.
So exciting. There's one more thing that I would really love to talk to you about, which is comes back to your other work as well. And you do more than just obviously talk about small file media, but the term that really struck out when I was reading about it in some of your work is, I hope I pronounce it correctly, soul.
Oh, how nice. Thank you so much for asking, Nadine. Soul assemblages. You're like people who do a new materialist analysis. I think that, you know, every entity in the world has some kind of life. You know, I think a data center, well, and the thing that I add to it is where there is life, there is a soul. And I don't mean this in a kind of transcendental way, but just in the sense that a soul is this kind of private enclosed space that is able to do something in the world. So a data center has a soul, a movie has a soul, and so when all of these souls come together to do something, it makes an even larger soul, a temporary soul that I call a soul assemblage. So it's a really nice way to do a material analysis where you think, okay, into the soul assemblage of streaming media, enter not only, you know, filmmakers and actors and streaming platforms and audiences, but also, you know, the devices on which we're playing back, and the data centers and the networks and the energy sources. You know, so that the soul of petroleum is in our movies, and I actually think of oil as being full of the souls of the fossilized plants and animals that. Mm-hmm. Millions of years died, you know, eventually turned into what we use as fossil fuels. So if you think about all those souls that are gathered together to support our watching of streaming movies, then I think it gives us a more kind of a feeling of awe and respect, and a wish to participate in soul assemblages that are not unhealthy for our cosmos, but healthy for the cosmos. So here we could also think about, you know, not only the fossils within the earth, but our dear sun, you know, our own personal star, which we count on so much. And how could we have a more healthy relationship with the sun, both in terms of greenhouse gases and in terms of solar power? I think the goal of, first, like figuring out what kind of soul assemblages we are involved in, and then assessing the health of those soul assemblages and seeing if we can make them healthier is a really good thing to do in our lives.
I think this is a beautiful, beautiful term and a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for being a part of this episode and jumping on and sharing this complete wealth of information. It's just a huge topic. You have so much knowledge. And so I'm just very happy to have had this tidbit part of this journey. Thank you.
Well, I'm grateful to you, Nadine. I thought your questions were just...
Dr. Mark's long-awaited new book named The Fold, From Your Body to the Cosmos, will be published this month, March 2024. Her previous books are also linked below. I'd highly recommend getting your hands on some if you're interested in film theory, intercultural studies, and philosophy. Now, the report we've spoken about, Tackling the Carbon Footprint of Streaming Media, is also linked below and free to download. My utmost gratitude and respect to Dr. Marks. I very much enjoyed our time together. And thank you, listener, for joining us. And as always, you can send us feedback or any thoughts on the episode, inherlenspodcast@gmail.com. And also, you can join us on Instagram @inherlenspodcast. I will be back next week with a new episode in this season on climate and film, the impact of our storytelling. Make sure to follow the podcast and hit the little bell to not miss it. And I look forward to seeing you there. Cheers. Bye.